I'm David Schreiner-Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Jordan Eisenberg. Jordan is a serial entrepreneur. He's the founder and CEO of Urgent RX, which produces a line of fast-acting, portable, over-the-counter medications that provide right-now relief for today's busy, on-the-go consumer. The brand has been featured in the New York Times, Entrepreneur, Fortune, CNN, The Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and Forbes. Jordan's prior entrepreneurial activities include the Buddy Network, which is a consumer web and mobile app business that launched a top iPhone app. He was also involved in a successful promotional products business based on products he invented and patented, and a medical device that Jordan invented and licensed to a major manufacturer. Jordan began his career working for an investment bank. In addition to his entrepreneurial activities that I just described, Jordan also sits on several boards, including venture capital fund Lazarus Investment Partners, the Jake Jabs Center for Entrepreneurship at the University of Colorado Denver, as well as several startup companies. Jordan was also a Dean's List scholar at Vanderbilt University, where he graduated with a double major in computer science and mathematics. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you live in Denver.
I do.
Which is a great place, and I'm glad to have you on. And I also noticed in your background that you like to build stuff, right? And also, you know, being a computer science and math major, I'm guessing that probably has that's in sync with this, your background and your interest in building stuff. But tell me about your interest in building stuff and what that's all about.
Sure. You know, I've always really enjoyed the prospect of creating something from nothing. And, you know, starting from when I was young all the way through college and into my professional career, I think that's been a theme. You know, certainly having a collegiate focus on mathematics and engineering was all about solving problems and building solutions, and I think that certainly trained me in terms of how to think in a business setting.
And along that theme, how did you figure out what it is you like doing and what you don't like doing?
You know, my first job out of college was working for an investment bank, and you know, it's this lauded career path that, well, at least when I graduated, was the quote best job you could get. And I got the job, and I only lasted a few months because honestly, I'm just not a great employee because I'm so focused on operating outside of the box and doing things that I'm passionate about. And often when you work inside of a big company, you're not doing what you're passionate about, you're doing what you're told to do. And that just never worked well for me. So early in my career, I learned what I don't want to do and also figured that if I'm going to work this hard, I'd rather do it for myself than for someone else. So I have a history now of building things from scratch, and it's really fun. It's certainly not easy. In fact, it's much harder than working for someone else, but it's very meaningful, and for me, it's very fulfilling.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that being an entrepreneur is a lot harder than being an employee. But you've actually describe something that is pretty common, which is people who are entrepreneurs generally don't make good employees.
I would agree. I think it's definitely a theme. You know, kind of you march to the beat of your own drum, and you know, you really are out trying to do things that only you see, and often the world doesn't see it until you've made enough progress that it becomes apparent or obvious. But in the beginning, you know, everything that you go up against is adversity. You know, people telling you they don't like your idea, investors telling you they don't want to invest in your company, you know, difficulty hiring people because it's so early stage and so forth. And, you know, when you take that mentality of somebody who can overcome all of that and still be passionate in the face of all of those challenges, often it's just not a great skill set inside a company.
Yeah, you do have a lot of people telling you either that you're nuts for doing what you're doing or that are telling you no, what you're doing, we just don't want to be involved, or your idea has no merit. There are a lot of naysayers.
Yeah, or come back when you're further along, which is kind of the inherent catch-22 because you need those people's support to get there. And, you know, you have to have a very high tolerance for pain. And, you know, almost an inability to let the wind go out of your sails. You know, like, honestly, you know, I like to say that I step in shit and then I say, where's the pony?
So that being said, what, and you've done this now several times successfully, what tips can you offer about how to have the mindset to be persistent in the face of what seem like tons of obstacles and in particular lots of naysayers?
Well, you know, I think it has to come from within. I think if you're looking externally for that validation, it's going to be really, really tough at the beginning. And it has to be something that when you look in the mirror and when you stare at the ceiling at night, is just this mantra of never give up. I'm onto something. I love this. This is what I want to do. And if you try to look outside for validation, it's going to be really tough, especially at the beginning. But even as things get going, there's always bumps in the road. I mean, people look at any startup and any level of success and they just see the highlights and they see how great it was. But there's a lot of challenges along the way, and you can't stop. You can't give up. Like I said earlier, having a high tolerance for pain and just a lot of grit, I think, is absolutely critical. And a lot of that is something you're born with. It's hard to gain it if you're not like that by nature.
Yeah, I think I would agree. I work a lot with mid-career leaders, and these are people who have had multiple successes in their professional lives, whether it's running a business or in other settings, and they still have self-doubt, but they're generally able to overcome the self-doubt, although it does have its challenges.
Absolutely.
One of the issues that I see people struggling with is how to find the balance, or maybe the intersection, between personal fulfillment and profitability. So you've described being an entrepreneur because you love what you do and you know what you're good at and you know what you enjoy spending time doing. So how do you find a way that combines that with being profitable? Because a lot of people struggle with that.
You know, it's hard to give a simple answer because a lot of these gigantic companies and even some of these, you know, so-called unicorns are not profitable. So it doesn't mean they're not valuable, but they're not profitable. So, you know, often it takes a tremendous amount of capital to get to the point of profitability. And frankly, some businesses are built for acquisition as opposed to built for profitability. So, it's a little bit myopic, I think, just to think about profitability, but I do think it's also a slippery slope to just assume that somebody will buy it if you can build it. So it really depends on the industry. It depends on the business. And again, I think there's a lot of nuance to it.
Interesting. So would you say that it's more important to focus on the personal fulfillment?
I think it depends on the personality. I mean, you know, I think when entrepreneurs set out to do this for money, it's really tough because, you know, candidly, our society focuses in on the Zuckerbergs of the world and these unbelievably successful people. But, you know, when it's all said and done, a lot of these entrepreneurs would have made more money had they stayed in their careers. Now, I think long term, it will benefit the entrepreneur. But in the short run, you know, your friends are making way more money than you are because you're scraping something together. And very rarely is it something that's just a cash cow early on. So if you're doing it just for the personal profitability or what have you, I think that's challenging. You know, I do this because I want freedom more than anything, but also because I'm passionate about it. It's really fun for me, as I said earlier, to create something out of nothing, to be able to touch consumers' lives, to be able to travel to a city I've never been and see my product on the shelf, and then to hear from customers that have used my products and like them. You know, I hope the money comes, but certainly not the only motivation.
Right. Okay, so it's interesting that you're not describing the money as the primary motivation to get started.
I mean, I think, you know, you take like a macro look. I think, you know, when you look at like major creators of wealth in society, you know, being an entrepreneur, is one of those major catalysts where, you know, few industries short of becoming the CEO of a public company really can afford the ability to make a ton of money. I mean, maybe if you're a very successful attorney that does class action, or if you're a investment banker or a private equity guy, you can make a ton of money. But, you know, there's when you look at, again, from a macro standpoint, the huge wealth creators very often are entrepreneurs. So there's certainly that allure. And, you know, we don't want to suggest as entrepreneurs that we're these, you know, bleeding liberals who are doing it just for the sake of personal fulfillment. I mean, certainly we're all motivated by the ultimate prize. My point is simply that if the financial outcome is the only goal, I think you're going to have a hard time being an entrepreneur, because very rarely does the cash come quickly or easily.
Good point. So I wondered if we could turn a little bit to talk about this theme of smashing the plateau, right? Which is the whole motivation behind this show. And in particular, when companies have been around for a while, they've gotten past that initial stage. So there clearly is a market for what they offer. They've had some successes, but then they plateau and they keep hitting roadblocks. What do you see as some of the critical shift points that business owners need to navigate in order to get their business to the next level?
You know, honestly, I think, you know, you do see that it's kind of a phenomenon. I think really what it comes down to is the team. And a team that gets you from an idea to a product may not be the team that gets you from a product to market, and that may not be the team that gets you from kind of a startup to a successful business. And, you know, you want to surround yourself with the absolute best people that you can. And it's not necessarily a dig against those early teams, just that it's a very different skill set. And often, you know, entrepreneurs themselves may not be great managers. I mean, I can tell you that I think I'm a good leader, but I don't particularly think I'm a good manager. And so I've had to find people that work on my team and work with me to manage, because it's not my skill set. And I've had, you know, variations of the team from kind of 1.0 to 2.0 to 3.0. And these are teams that can take you to the next level, but that would not necessarily fit or even want to be a part of the other chapter.
Talk to me about leader versus manager. What do you see as the difference?
You know, I think a manager is somebody who's really good at motivating people and really good at, you know, communicating to them what they want, thinking about growth and development and bringing structure into an organization, whereas entrepreneurs are often very, very high level, focused on the big picture and focused on product, perhaps focused on being the face of the brand, you know, being the early salesperson and so forth. And it's not a positive or a negative, it's just that it's not that common that that skill set is the same skill set as somebody who's really good at understanding interpersonal dynamics of a team, making sure that people are feeling developed and cared for and so forth. Even if you do very well, you know, care for these people and want to develop them, it just may not be your skill set.
Right. That's a very good way to describe the difference. And what do you see as some of the key elements to be able to create a successful team?
You know, I think certainly in an early stage business, you need to get people who are self-starters. You can't really have people in an early stage business that you have to push and micromanage and crack the whip, because, you know, you're overworked yourself. And so, you know, for me as a young entrepreneur, you know, historically and to date, I've been the youngest person on my executive team. I've hired people around me who have more experience than I do. And I think that's really important, because a pitfall, you know, maybe it works in the Valley in some instances, but finding very, very hungry and talented and smart young people can work really, really hard, but you have no shortcut for wisdom and experience. And what I've seen in my personal life is that when you have really hungry young people, you may all stand shoulder to shoulder and work your ass off going down path A, not even realizing that you should have been going down path B.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's
no shortcut for the experience. Again, I mean, it's so great to get people who've seen the movie before, because, you know, you could work your ass off trying to accomplish a goal and do it wrong, and you don't know that you're doing it wrong because you don't know what right looks like.
Now, there's certain things that do come with wisdom and experience. I mean, I see, as an example, one of the traits that people who have more wisdom and experience have is understanding the need for certain kinds of help on a team.
Sure.
And not thinking that you can do everything yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the antonym to that is that you also need some of that, like, blind naivete where you always believe because
right.
how hard it was going to be and you knew it was stacked up against you, you may not do it.
True, true. What are some techniques you use in acquiring talent?
You know, I've always wanted to find people that kind of share in the vision and that can see it without a tremendous amount of convincing, kind of what you want to do and why you want to do it. You know, very specifically, I'm a big believer in sharing equity. I think bringing people in, especially in an early stage business, and letting them feel like they're owners is really important.
Talk to me a little bit about company culture and what it takes to create the right environment.
You know, honestly, that's something that I think is an ongoing challenge. I walk into some of these companies that have just energy and electricity in the air, and I'm in awe. It's really difficult to figure that out, and I think, I don't think it's easy. I think it's iterative. I think it's ongoing. You know, even at my business, we've gone through periods where culture is great, culture is bad, culture is great, culture is bad, and it's almost like an organism in and of itself that, you know, somebody once said to me, culture's not a problem until it's a problem, and then it's your biggest problem. And I think that's an interesting perspective, because when you're focused on product and selling and raising capital and getting out there, you almost think like the culture will take care of itself. But, you know, it sounds very trite and cliched, but the culture of your business and the people in your business are everything. And if you don't have that right, it makes everything harder.
Jordan, are there things that you've done that you've seen as a result, you have seen a major difference in the kind of culture that comes about?
Yeah, I mean, I think being open and being real with your team is pretty critical. If you're, you know, kind of faking it and bullshitting, I think people can sniff that out. So when things are good, celebrate the wins, and when things aren't good, don't try to pull the wool over people. I think you got to share it and be real. I think you just have to be human. You know, some people are really, really good at, you know, keeping an arm's length, but maybe that works in a big company or a big organization where there's just so much inertia that it's not that critical. But in an early stage company, I think you just have to be very real.
So what's an example of being open and real?
Again, when there's any type of bad news, share it with the team. When there's adversity, I mean, they're going to find out anyways, and they can read your body language and so forth. So you just have to be open about your challenges. But I think the flip side to that is to not forget to celebrate the wins. When something exciting or good happens, you know, take some time to pull the team together and celebrate.
So what would happen as an example? I know I've seen people come across this situation where the bad news is that there's been a major downturn in sales and we don't have the capital to support the payroll that we have because of the downturn in sales, and clearly there need to be some cutbacks.
Yep.
Right? You as the business owner are going to be the first one probably to find that out, but you might not be able to make the decision about who gets cut immediately. But if you share that news, everybody's going to get scared.
They are going to get scared, but I think to let that information slowly leak out will do more damage than pulling the team together and just addressing it and allowing them to, you know, ask questions and answer their questions honestly is the better way to go. You're going to go through these tough times. You're going to have to go through periods of times where you probably will have to lay people off, and it sucks. It's the worst. But, you know, again, if you don't tell anybody and all of a sudden, you know, Jim and Sally and Bill's cubes are empty and you don't address it, the rumor mill starts, and the rumor mill can be really dangerous. So I think it's important just to address it and own it and say, yeah, you know, it sucks. Don't try to sugarcoat it, but that these are the things we're going to do to move forward. And by the way, who in this room has other ideas of things we could be working on?
Yeah, this sounds reasonable. Jordan, where have you had some of your challenges and how have you overcome them?
You know, I think there's always challenges in growth and understanding how to manage the growth. Certainly, you know, my business, we've had to raise capital, and that's always really hard. You know, taking people's money is really challenging. And then, you know, certainly when you're going out and you're trying to sell customers and not everybody's going to say yes, you know, you're so optimistic that what I've seen happen a lot is, specifically from a sales standpoint, you want a yes so badly that you will put yourself in purgatory of maybe, and you'll deal with customers saying maybe for months and months and months, and they're going to be a no in the end, but you just can't give up. And so what I've experienced is that the second best thing to a yes is a quick no. And while there are Goliath customers that you can never give up on, it's kind of that bell curve of medium-sized customers that you can just really spin your wheels with. And we've been guilty of that. And I think every company that's selling something to somebody has been guilty of that too.
I think that's very true. What questions do you wish you had answered when you hit a plateau?
You know, I think I just wish I would have had more people early on that had seen the movie before and just say, hey, you know, you have the benefit of pattern recognition. Look at the challenges I have right now. Am I lying to myself, or is it just that I have to keep going and success is just around the corner?
So speaking of people who might have some wisdom, who have been some of your influencers that have been really pivotal for you in your career?
I spent a few years working under a guy named Maurice Kanbar, who probably has had more impact on me personally in my career than anybody. I actually read his book in an entrepreneurship class when I was an undergrad, and I said, I'm going to work for this guy someday, and I basically tracked him down, and this is before social media, got in touch with him, and called him pretty much once a month for 2 years until he said, stop calling me or come work for me. So
that's pretty relentless.
Yeah, persistence, right?
Yep.
And I started calling him when I was in college, and when I graduated and had a real job, that's when that happened, and I left kind of the, quote, real world and went to go work for him, and it was a wild experience, but I was just an absolute sponge, and you get so many lessons learning from a successful entrepreneur that you just can't get out of a book or you can't get out of an MBA program. So for me, it was just an amazing, amazing opportunity to work directly for, you know, somebody that I believe is one of the most impressive living entrepreneurs in my field, which is consumer goods.
That's a great example. Have there been other influencers, either people, people or other kinds of influencers?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I give a lot of credit to my parents. They're supportive, and I'm fortunate that I have parents who are supportive, even when, you know, I tell them that I'm going to leave the investment banking world, which is a little bit hard to reconcile, because I think a lot of parents would think that getting a job like that out of college, you kind of got the path, and, you know, it took a lot of courage and pride for me to say, this is not what I want to do. And, you know, fortunately, even if my parents kind of scratched their heads, they said, all right, well, you know, I'm sure you know. And then in addition to that, you know, specifically within this business, I've surrounded myself with people who've been successful in my industry, and I've added many of these people to my board and to my advisory board. So again, going back to try to gain wisdom from people who've been down the path and recognize that, you know, most of the challenges that you have in some flavor are similar to the challenges that they've had too.
Those are great examples. Jordan, what are you working on now? What do we have to look forward to?
At UrgentRx, you know, we continue to build distribution, and that's a huge focus of ours. We want to build distribution into as many channels as we can get into. We want to ensure that, you know, we grow brand awareness with consumers, and we think that there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in front of us, and look for partners who can help us get there.
Tell me a little bit more about your product.
We make a line of flavored, powdered, over-the-counter drugs that are single-dose OTCs. So we have six different products. We have an aspirin product specifically formulated to treat heart attacks, which has saved 17 or 18 lives as of last count. It's carried by ski patrols and EMTs and, you know, large airlines across the country, which is a pretty amazing thing. We have basically our version of a Benadryl. The product is called diphenhydramine, and that's for people who have severe allergies like myself. We have a upset stomach product, which is very similar to a Pepto-Bismol. We have an ache and pain product, which is similar to an Excedrin. We have a heartburn product, which is similar to a Tums. And then we have a headache relief product, which is very similar to a Tylenol. So almost identical active ingredients, but in our format, which is a a line of flavored powdered products that you can rip open the packet, pour it in your mouth, and it works very fast. It also doesn't need liquid. And we have a patent on the fact that it's credit card size. You can actually stick it in your wallet, and it's kind of there when you need it. And really what dawned on me at the beginning is that ailments don't happen when you're standing in a pharmacy or standing at home next to your medicine cabinet, but rather when you're out living your life. And you know, I thought there's got to be a better solution than just wrapping up pills in cellophane and sticking them in your pocket.
Yeah, but this sounds like a major breakthrough in terms of kind of product or way of delivering something that has been delivered all over the world for years and years and years.
We think so. Yeah, I mean, I you know, irrespective of the fact that I started the company, I take my products. I like them, and I think it's better than taking a pill because they work fast and they're there when I need it. So, you know, I really started this business because for years I was taking Benadryl and putting it in my wallet because I have all these food allergies. And they would get crushed, they would fall out, it wasn't sanitary, they taste really bad. And, you know, what are the odds that you're out of the house and you have an allergic reaction, you have a pill? Pretty low. Well, what are the odds that you're in that situation and you have a pill and liquid? Even lower. So, you know, I really created this for me initially and then realized that this is not an unusual occurrence, and I think a lot of people can relate to it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you identified a need based on your own personal experience that turned out to be a huge hole in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also, you know, we've created a brand personality that targets kind of a younger demographic. When you look at the universe of over-the-counter drugs, the big brands that are out there have been out there for tens of years, and in some instances over 100 years. And the personalities of these brands are, you know, kind of serious and staid and not that fun. And I thought, why not bring a fun personality to the OTC universe and look to innovate within the consumer healthcare space and make products that are relevant to me and my demographic as opposed to just my parents?
Very clever. Very clever.
Thanks.
Jordan, who do you know personally who's doing really remarkable work?
A lot of people. I think, you know, just based on the market right now and how crazy things are, there's a lot of amazing companies out there. You'd mentioned at the beginning of this interview that I sit on the board of a venture capital firm called Lazarus, which is a VC firm here in Denver. And I'm totally blown away and impressed with what they're doing. And in a nutshell, what Lazarus is doing is they're exclusively investing in companies in Israel. And, you know, the more kind of Western media paints this picture of chaos in the Middle East, the more U.S. investors in particular shy away from Israel, where Israel, I think, is just an unbelievable hub of innovation and technology that that these guys are capitalizing upon, and they're doing a great job.
Have you read the book Startup Nation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. It talks about that.
Yeah, I mean, that is very much tied into what they are doing.
That sounds very exciting. Jordan, how can listeners learn more about you?
You know, by Googling UrgentRx in my name, I think you'll find a lot of really interesting information, and certainly just visiting our website, which is UrgentRx.com, or following us on Facebook or Twitter or any type of social media is a great way.
Well, certainly what you're doing with UrgentRx sounds really groundbreaking. I think what you've done in the course of your career is something that is... I think will be really inspirational for a lot of people listening to this podcast. So I wanted to thank you for taking the time to join me today, for being candid about your own experiences and the ups and downs, and for sharing lots of tips that I think our listeners will find really valuable. So thank you. My guest today has been Jordan Eisenberg, serial entrepreneur and the founder and CEO of UrgentRx. Thank you again, Jordan, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.